This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, I'm Sharmila Ganesan and welcome to History on Repeat on The Bigger Picture. This is a new 8-part mini-series that aims to delve into key aspects of Malaysian history. Now, while we won't be able to cover every period and topic of our vast and complex past, we will be having a series of conversations on key subjects, places and themes and discussing why our history still matters today. So for our very first episode, we will be taking a look at the roots of the Malay world through the lens of archaeology. And I have with me Dr. Nasha Rodziadi Kaur, lecturer in the Centre for Global Archaeological Research at the University of Science Malaysia. Thank you for joining me, Dr. Nasha.
Thank you for having me here.
So maybe we can start off with a little bit of Archaeology 101, to kind of set the scene. How is the discipline of archaeology different from history in the way that it approaches the study of the past?
Both archaeology and history concerns with the study of human activities in the past, but the difference lies in the kind of materials that we are dealing with. For history, most of the materials concerns around the study of written records, documents and archival records, while archaeological research focuses on the material remains of human beings. So we go for the tangible artifacts such as artifacts, ecofacts, structural remains and biofacts. Mm. So it is the material which become the point of departure for our argument.
So what is the role of these materials and these artifacts in providing information, say in the cases when, as you mentioned, the texts or the inscriptions are rare or even non-existent?
Well, there are many aspects where historical documents cannot be able to answer regarding the culture of the past human beings, you know. This is due to the fact that most historical texts can be altered throughout the time. But as far as material remains are concerned, when we do the excavations, then it is the kind of evidences which cannot be doubted anymore. You know, it is the kind of remains that which give direct insight into the activities and cultures of the past, you see. So based on these remains, we can be able to reconstruct the culture of the ancient human being in terms of the religion, customs, etc. So this kind of evidences cannot be reconstructed based on historical text itself.
So are there particular challenges or even opportunities when it comes to archaeology in Malaysia, given both the weather, the geography of this region, as well as the particular history itself?
Okay, as far as archaeological research is concerned, the main challenges is in terms of the weather and in terms of the environment.
Right.
You see, we have a very tropical weather, very hot and humid. Due to this weather, most of the archaeological or material remains cannot last for long. So we have to base our argument on imperishable materials such as stones, stonewares, ceramics, etc. So based on these materials, we have to do our interpretations. However, we have to bear in mind that most of the material culture in the Malay Peninsula are based on perishable materials. So whatever we found on the archaeological site only consisted less than 10% of the material culture. So we have to extrapolate lots of things from our research.
Is this sort of abundance of perishable material culture something that's unique to the Malay region?
Exactly. Yeah, because we know that most of the perishable materials cannot last for more than 100 years. So for this kind of material culture, we have to base our research on ethnographical research, you know, by studying the orang asli, etc. Because the research on orang asli give us some insight regarding how the kind of culture could have happened during the proto-historic period. So we have to go to the culture which has not been affected by the modernities yet.
Mm.
You know? So that is how we supplement our data.
So could you give us a brief survey of the early archaeological sites in the Malay Peninsula?
The Malay Peninsula had a very long cultural evolution from the prehistoric period towards the early modern period. So we begin with the prehistoric period where we have the Paleolithic period, the Hobbitian period, up to the Neolithic period. And then we enter the late prehistoric period where the human being started to be able to smelt iron, to produce iron artifacts. And somewhere in 500 BC, there was some connection or context between India, China with the Malay Peninsula. And in the 2nd century BC, we saw the rise and fall of early polities. And it followed until the 14th century CE, where we see the rise of many kingdoms. Mm. And after that, we have the Islamic period and the colonial period. So it is a history of pretty much like 100 to 200,000 years of evolution.
So when we talk about the archaeological sites, what are some of the main ones?
Well, as far as the prehistoric site, we have plenty of them. You know, we have the Paleolithic sites of Lenggong Valley. We have the Hobbinian sites in Hulu, Terengganu, Hulu, Kelantan. And we have the most important archaeological site as far as the proto-historic period is concerned is in ancient Kedah or Bujang Valley, where discovered lots of iron smelting sites, Hindu and Buddhist remains, as well as trade remains.
And I mean, I suppose from a layperson's point of view, if I were to ask, how long have people been living in the Malay Peninsula?
We have evidences since 1.83 million years ago.
Oh, wow.
1.83 million years, you know, from the Paleolithic period. And it continues up to the Malacca Sultanate and until today, you know. So we have evidences since the early meteorite impact in 1.83 million and it continued to evolve.
So let's zoom in on your primary area of archaeological work, which is, you know, you mentioned Bujang Valley, and that's where the bulk of your work has been focused, Bujang Valley in Kedah. Firstly, what, you know, when were these sites first documented and who found them?
Well, the archaeological sites of Bujang Valley was first reported in the year 1842 by Colonel James Lau. Okay, he's a British administrator in the Strait Settlement. And he reported some epigraphic remains, a big inscription written in Brahmi script, as well as several structures. And after the 1840s, there were interest by the British officers to do a survey in the Bujang Valley. And they started to discover lots of architectural remains, lots of icons, etc. However, before the 1937, most of the research were just to recover the antiquities, you know. Those are not research to answer the question regarding the history of the area, but they just wanted to retrieve the artifacts. But it is only after 1937 that proper research method were followed, you know, to reconstruct the history of the area.
So am I correct in assuming that, you know, from the 19th century up to maybe around the Second World War, it was a fairly colonial approach to archaeology?
Yeah, so we call it an antiquarian approach, where the main purpose of the research is to find antiquities. And the kind of antiquities they were focusing on are the kind of materials which had certain level of aesthetical values, you know. And they usually would discard less important artifacts such as ceramics, etc. But those artifacts are very important to us today. So they wanted something which can be used as decorations, something which looks appealing to them. And that's why the history of the area was quite blurred before the Second World War.
Right. I'm particularly interested in, you know, and this keeps coming up in some of the, in the writings about Bujang Valley, the research conducted by H.G. Quaritch Wales and his wife Dorothy. Their approach is different from these earlier methods?
Yes, of course. Because these Quaritch Wales and Mrs. Wales, they do a proper documentation on 31 archaeological sites in the Bujang Valley. They give attention, lots of attention, in fact, to the foreign trade wares discovered in the area. And they managed to suggest a new theory regarding the cultural evolution of Kedah and the periodization of Kedah history. So before them, there was no such thing. So they did not really tell the history of the area. So it is only Quaritch Wales and his wife, Dorothy Wales, who managed to propose a hypothesis regarding the history of Kedah. Although the hypothesis has been refuted today, but actually it was a first attempt to really give a complete history of the area.
And to what extent were these investigations sort of tied up with ideas of Orientalism, of imperialism, and, you know, of course, the British Empire as well?
Okay, we know that H.G. Quaritch Wales was funded by the Greater India Society. So they tried to promote the idea regarding the position of ancient Kedah as the extension of the Indian civilization. Yeah, because they are being funded by these people. So, of course, their ideas are aligned to the main ideology of that association. So we cannot be able to, it's very difficult, in fact, to be for us to really separate from this kind of bias in research. You know, it is something that very hard for us to avoid. So that is a normal thing in academic interpretations.
Is there evidence that there was local interest in these sites before independence, you know, during the same period in time?
As far as the published materials are concerned, most of the papers published on ancient Kedah were by the foreign researchers. So we started to have local researchers in the area maybe in the 60s. So as far as the researchers are concerned, before the independence, so most of them are being done by foreign researchers.
So post-independence, when we first start seeing our local researchers going in, how did the method of study of these sites change?
Well, in the year 1957, we have another scholar. His name is Alastair Lamb. So he adopted a more systematic way of excavating the site. So for H.G. College Whale, he simply dig out the site to expose the structure. But Alastair Lamb, he did the excavation layer by layer by looking at the stratigraphy, and he paid lots and lots of attention to the ceramics. We know that most of the ceramics came from China, Persia and Arabia, and the dating on the ceramic can be able to give a very accurate cultural sequence of the site. So the research adopted by Lamb had given a more refined chronology of the area, and after Lamb, we have more local scholars who managed to, you know, improve the method done by Lamb, and as a result, we have a better hypothesis on Ancient Kedah.
So once this shift happens towards more local scholars, do we see a moving away from this idea, you called it antiquarian earlier, this Orientalism, this antiquarian approach?
Yes, of course. So started somewhere in the 70s. So the Malaysian government started to hire, to train lots of local archaeologists, among them Datuk Nia Hassan Suhaimi, Zuraina Majid, Leong Sao Heng. So these are the scholars who follow a more holistic way of doing archaeological site, and they have also started to use scientific approach to interpret the archaeological data. So as a result, we can see a more organized research there, you know, and the hypothesis and the thesis proposed by them become more convincing because they know how to interpret the data according to proper methodology.
Okay. I have a lot more questions about your work with Bujang Valley, but we do need to take a quick break. You're listening to History on Repeat, our new 8-part mini-series where we discuss key subjects, places and themes in Malaysia's past and why they matter today. I'm speaking to Dr. Nasha Rodziadi Kaur, lecturer in the Centre for Global Archaeological Research, University Science Malaysia, about archaeology and the roots of the Malay world. We'll be back after a short break on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to History on Repeat, the 8-part mini-series where we discuss key subjects, places and themes in Malaysia's past and why they matter today. So for this first episode, I'm speaking with Dr. Nasha Rodziadi Kaur, lecturer in the Centre for Global Archaeological Research, University Science Malaysia, about the role of archaeology in the roots of the Malay world. So Dr. Nasha, before the break, you sort of set up for us how the research in Bujang Valley in Kedah started and evolved to the present day. Now, coming to the present, I think is when we'll get into your own investigations, right? You know, compared to the earlier research that had been done, can you give us a description of what we currently know about the Bujang Valley sites and what do they tell us about ancient Kedah?
The University of Science Malaysia, you know, had started our research somewhere in the year 2009. And from our research, we started to get new insights regarding the cultural makeup and the demography of ancient Kedah. Prior to the year 2009, most of the research concerns around interpreting the remains, you know, regarding the trade of the area and regarding the evolution of the social culture there. However, we have adopted a different kind of research where we try to relate, in fact, the demography of the area with the paleo-environmental aspect of the region. And we managed to conclude that ancient Kedah was not actually a single polity or a single cultural block, but ancient Kedah was a collection of different settlements practicing different cultures, and at the same time, they have their own functions. So we have a settlement which functioned as an iron smelting site. We have a settlement which functioned as a bead-making industry. We have areas where they only do international trade. And we have also settlements which are located in the inland area where they gather all the rainforest product to be sold to the foreign traders. Mm. So we came to the conclusion that ancient Kedah was more complex than what it was thought. And as far as the culture is concerned, people used to believe that people in ancient Kedah were entirely Hindu Buddhist or at least influenced by Hindu Buddhist culture. But we found out that that was not the case. There were some settlements of Hindu and Buddhist people on the coastal area, but as far as the inland areas, and these people, they continue to practice their own animistic beliefs. Mm. So the dynamicity of the settlements of ancient Kedah is quite different from what we used to think, you know, before the year 2008.
And of course, your primary approach is archaeology.
Yeah.
Can you explain the connection between the material of evidence that you found with these findings?
Okay, most of the archaeological sites which can be somehow related to the Indian culture are located only on the coastal areas. You know, however, we know that there were lots of settlement, there were lots of population located in the inland areas. So it shows like a very different cultures practice by the people in the coastal area and the inland area. And most of the archaeological sites related to the Hindu-Buddhist culture seem to overlap with the trading points. So we came to believe that most of the Hindu-Buddhist sites were left by the Indian traders and they were built in collaboration with the local settlement. The connection that we can see between these archaeological findings with the local people still remain our hypothesis. We are not sure about that yet. But we can suggest that those sites were built by the foreign traders in collaboration with the locals, you know? So they have to depend on the local in terms of the manpower, in terms of the raw materials. But as far as the architecture, as far as the funding used to build these materials, then it came from the foreign traders.
Right.
Yep.
So this is going to be another archaeology 101 question.
Yep.
How are these artifacts from these sites recovered, identified, dated? What's the process?
Okay, the first process is, we call it the archaeological survey. During the archaeological survey, we are going to determine the potential area where the archaeological sites can be found. Usually, during an archaeological survey, we are going to base our prediction on paleo-environmental reconstruction, where we are going to draw the line of ancient coastline. The geography of the area today is totally different from the 14th century CE. So we are going to go to the area where there was high probability there were settlements, usually in the river estuary or ancient coastline. And then we will go to the area and we are going to carry out geo-archaeological survey. We are going to do some geophysical survey as well to know where archaeological sites can be found. And if there are sites, then we are going to proceed with the excavation.
Right.
Yep.
And, you know, are these technologies or techniques that, are they different depending on the type of site, depending on the weather and stuff like that?
Definitely. Some of the archaeological sites can be visible from the surface, on the surface. But as far as Bujang Valley sites are concerned, most of them are buried underneath the soil, like 1 or 2 meters. So we need to use special techniques to detect the sites. So we call it the geomagnetic method or the geophysical methods, you know, where we are going to shoot some magnetic wave into the soil.
Really?
and then we will know that something is being buried there. And then we are going to open a trial trench just 1 by 1 meter. We are going to dig down, and if we find something, then we are going to open the whole site. So we need a special physical method to detect the site which is being buried underneath the soil.
So based on the information we currently have, do we know when habitation of the Bujang Valley began?
Based on our carbon dating, as well as OSL dating on the iron smelting site in Sungai Batu, we believe that ancient Kedah started as a late prehistoric settlement somewhere in the 7th century BC. However, ancient Kedah started to establish trade links with southern India somewhere in the 2nd century BC. Based on the Tamil poem we found, you
right.
know, during the Sangam period. And from 2nd century BC onwards, then ancient Kedah started to develop to become an international emporium due to the continuous arrival of traders coming from India and China, you know. So we believe that the actual date where ancient Kedah was recognized as an international port was 2nd century BC.
And did habitation patterns in the valley change over time? And, you know, if they did, why?
Definitely, because as a trading settlement, the rise and fall of ancient Kedah depends on international market. And ancient Kedah was known to be one of the main producers of iron on the shores of the Strait of Malacca. And they cater for the Western market, especially for India and Arab. So the rise and fall of ancient Kedah depends on its economy, and their economy depends on how much iron they can sell. So there are rise and fall of economy of ancient Kedah, but we know that for 1,500 years, ancient Kedah managed to maintain its existence. It is due to the fact that iron was a very important commodity in those days. It was used for everything.
Right.
For domestic purposes, you know, to make weapons, etc. So it is due to the presence of iron ore in that area, which make ancient Kedah to endure during the period of 1,500 years.
So I've never been to the Bujang Valley, but I do understand, and also from seeing from pictures, there are some pretty large structures that exist there. Now, what do these structures tell us about, you know, that time, about the society there? What do they mean?
Well, as far as the structures are concerned, if we wanted to compare the structure with other sites in Southeast Asia, the sites in Bujang Valley can be considered to be quite small. You know, the largest structure is somewhere around 30 meters, the largest one. So most of the structures can be built within the period of 2 to 3 months only. you know. And we know, based on the Arab records, that there were lots of Indian, Persian, Arab and Chinese settlements in that area, and they have to stay there for 6 months, whether right. they like it or not, while waiting for monsoonal change, etc. Judging from all that facts, we believe that most of the structures were built by the communities of traders for personal worship or worship for a small group of people. And there were lots of sites, more than 200 sites.
Mm.
So that shows that ancient Kedah was a metropolitan area, number one. Number two, it is a multicultural, multi-religious area where people of different faith living together, trading with each other, and peacefully also, you know. We can know this based on the volume of trade which happened at that time. With political stability, they have the economic flourish.
Mm.
You know, so that is what we learned from the findings.
So that was almost exactly what I was going to ask you, because I was going to ask you, where did the inhabitants of ancient Kedah come from? And, you know, if you say that it's cosmopolitan, how did that cosmopolitanism happen?
Okay, we believe that there are two main elements of ancient Kedah demography. Number one is the native populations. So we believe that this native population consisted of the speakers of Austronesian language and Austroasiatic language. So Austronesian language is related to the modern Malay language, and the Austroasiatic are the Orang Aslis.
Mm.
And then we have another element, which are the foreign traders who need to stay there. You know, due to the location of ancient Kedah, they need to stop by and live there for 6 months or perhaps longer. So these people, the interaction between these two people produce the kind of archaeological remains that we have today. And these two group of people need to depend on each other. Most of the traders need to live on the coastal areas, and they had to depend on the native population who live further inland for the materials, for the construction materials, for food, etc. So it is the collaboration between these two group of people which managed to develop ancient Kedah. And we can see the same pattern of development during the Sultanate of Malacca,
right,
where there were lots of Indian settlers, there were lots of Chinese and Arabs there.
Mm.
So it continues from the proto-historic period into the early history period. So one thing that we can learn from our study in ancient Kedah and from the study of Malacca, that multiculturalism is something inevitable in the Malay Peninsula due to our location and our geostrategic position.
And how much of this multiculturalism was a deliberate act by the rulers of ancient Kedah?
We don't believe that it is a deliberate act. It is a historical accident due to the position itself. Because the traders have to come here, and the native population wants to make some profit from the arrival of the traders. So it is something very economical.
Sure.
And seeing that they're already here, so, you know, there's no such thing as political boundaries in those days. So people are free to come and leave, you know. So it is not something deliberate. It is something which is the most advantageous thing to do.
And it happens organically.
Yeah, it happens organically.
Mm-hmm. So when did Kedah, ancient Kedah rather, go into decline and why?
Okay, we believe that ancient Kedah started to decline somewhere in the end of the 14th century CE. And it is due to climate change in the environmental change.
I see.
Now, ancient Kedah used to be a very big bay. Okay, most of the bays are, you know, has already turned into dry land right now. And due to the large bay, the trading vessels can be able to go inland and take all the commodities, especially the iron ingots. Okay, iron ingots were the main export of ancient Kedah. However, somewhere in the mid-14th century, the bay started to seal up. Okay, and the sea level started to go down. As a result, the ships were not able to go near to the coast anymore.
I see.
And they were not able to transport the commodities. Okay?
Mm.
So as a result, they couldn't be able to trade. Okay, they cannot be able to transport the commodity from the coastline into the large vessel. So the trade declines, and with economic decline comes political decline.
Wow, okay. So we were facing climate change even back then.
Yes, and then that happened somewhere in the second half of the 14th century CE. And finally, in the year 1371, as been reported in Al-Tarikh Salasila Negeri Kedah, the king of Kedah transferred the capital from the Bujang Valley to the north.
Mm.
And only 30 years after that, in the year, less than 30 years, in the year 1398, the Malacca Sultanate was established.
Right.
And the traders were directed to the new port in Malacca. So we can see the continuation there. With the fall of ancient Kedah, in less than 3 years, we have a new port somewhere in the south.
Why is it that historically, the history of ancient Kedah is overshadowed by that of the Malacca Sultanate?
Okay, we have to remember one thing. The Malacca Sultanate only had 111 years of history.
Right.
While ancient Kedah had a history of almost 2,000 years. I mean, if you want to include the late prehistory period, almost 2,000 years. Malaccan history had been given lots of attention due to the abundance of historical records.
Right.
There were lots of records on Malacca. We have the Sejarah Melayu. We have Hikayat Hang Tuah. We have the Portuguese records. We have the Chinese records. Lots of people wrote about Melaka. Mm. So as a result, we managed to describe the society of Melaka from all aspects, from the jurisprudence, custom, religion, everything. But there is a problem with ancient Kedah as far as historical writings are concerned. There are very... The amount of historical record is very small, but we have lots of archaeological findings.
Mm.
That has led to a situation where we can only be sure about the economic position of ancient Kedah, but as far as the politic, custom and religion are concerned, things are open to interpretation.
Right.
Yeah. So there can be more than a strand of narrative regarding this aspect. So that's why not much is written on ancient Kedah because of the lack of written materials.
Are there materials or even archaeological evidence perhaps that exist in other parts of the world that perhaps we haven't yet begun to look at?
Definitely. Mm. Okay, we have at least, as far as we know, we have 4 inscriptions found in southern India which mention about Kedah. We have 1 inscription in northern Sumatra. Yeah. And... from these 5 inscriptions, we know that ancient Kedah was one of the main players of international trade and politics in the 11th century CE. Mm. However, these inscriptions were written by the southern Indians, by the foreign rulers. So as far as the reliability of the data, then it can be, you know, we need to be careful.
Right.
However, we know that ancient Kedah was very important to the foreign powers. But they only have like 1 or 2 paragraphs of ancient Kedah. So it is not enough for us to have a real complete history. So more research needs to be done.
So it is, as a matter of convenience almost, we tend to use the word the Malay world to refer to Malacca Sultanate, to Kedah. Mm-hmm. At what point in history can we actually begin using that term?
Well, you know, the Malay archipelago did not exist as a single cultural block. We have to bear that in mind.
Mm.
Because the Malay archipelago is a diverse region. It has a different geography. People living in different parts of the Malay archipelago has different type of culture. And they have different kind of reception to external cultural stimulus. For instance, people living in Java can receive Indian culture differently as compared to those living in Borneo. So we cannot paint the whole region with the same color.
Sure.
You know, and things are the same with the Malay Peninsula itself. Although people used to generalize that there were Hindu-Buddhist culture in the Malay Peninsula before the 14th century CE, we only have Hindu-Buddhist remains in ancient Kedah, but not in other areas. So if we want to interpret the history of the area accurately, so it is based on case basis. So people in ancient Kedah, probably they have the different culture as compared to people living in a different area because they evolve under different kind of environment. So I don't, well, we can use the term Malay world or Malay culture for the sake of convenience, but as far as academic research is concerned, we need to be precise.
Mm.
Malays living in which area?
Right.
You know?
So is it an applicable term to ancient Kedah in the period that you study?
Well, I try to restrain myself from using the word Malay culture when we wanted to study ancient Kedah because people in Kedah, they have their own way of evolving. You know, they have their own kind of evolution. Yes, the most probably they consisted of Austronesian speakers who are the ancestors of the Malays.
Mm.
But their culture may not necessarily be the same with those of the Malay Sultanate in Melaka. However, their economy is the same. Their political structure is the same. But as far as the customs are concerned, then we are not sure.
Right.
You know,
you were talking about the fact that this is your research area. What research plans do you have coming up in future in terms of the sites?
Yeah, okay. Like I've mentioned earlier, there are more than 200 sites in Bujang Valley. And each site is special. They have their own function, you know, they have different kind of religious affiliation. So currently I'm working on the site of Bukit Churas. It's located to the north of the Bujang Valley. It is located on top of a hill and it is a Buddhist site dated from the 7th century CE. So we are working on that site right now. And we are also doing small excavations in the Sungai Batu archaeological sites and we are not sure about the functions yet.
Right.
So there are still lots of research to be done. And we need more paleo-environmental study on that area, to confirm our findings. And we may never know what we may find in the future because there are still lots of undiscovered sites.
Are there particular things or particular areas or scopes that you hope to look at?
One thing which we are quite curious is, although ancient Kedah had a very long history, we have not found many inscriptions there. Okay, you see, during the proto-history period, before the 14th century, so our main point of departure are inscriptions. We have lots of inscriptions in Java. We have lots of inscriptions in India, in Indochina. But in the Bujang Valley, not much are being found. So we hope that in the future we can find more inscriptions which can tell regarding the political makeup or the cultural environment of the area. But we have not found yet.
Do you know why that's so? Why is it so difficult to find them?
Well, maybe it's due to the political situation there. You see, inscriptions are usually being issued by a king who managed to control the whole area. And like I've mentioned earlier, ancient Kedah was not...
They were individual polities.
Yeah. Ancient Kedah is not a unified polity, but it is just a group or confederation of different settlements. And each settlement probably was not even ruled by a king, maybe some chieftains, you know, and there could have been some figureheads there.
Yeah.
But we are not even sure about the identity of those figureheads.
So thinking more broadly, right, how does your work sort of get us to rethink how we think of Malaysia's past?
Okay, one most important thing that we can learn from ancient Kedah is the multiculturalism, and that the Chinese, Indians, Arabs have always been here as traders, of course. They had their temporary settlements. They stayed here for 6 months, and after favorable winds, they go back. But some, they stayed here. So it is due to this multiracial, multicultural past that ancient Kedah managed to develop itself from a late prehistoric settlement into an important emporium. It is due to cultural exchange, technological exchange, new ideas brought in from outside. It is due to this kind of past that ancient Kedah managed to develop. And the same thing happened in Malacca, where we can see that lots of Chinese and Indians, they hold important posts within the Malaccan court. You see? So we have to see this multiculturalism. It happened like 2,000 years ago. People managed to live in peace, peacefully in those days. Why can't we do the same today? You see?
Yeah. And finally, why do you believe that archaeological research into the ancient past matters?
Well, in contrast to historical research, archaeological research managed to give us the kind of material remains which we can touch, which we can see. So by looking at these remains, then we are sure that these people were there. You know, based on this kind of evidences, which become the point of departure of our argument, it gives us the sense of connection between us and our past, because the material remains are there and we know that it was being left there by our ancestors. So by looking at those remains, it gives us some kind of nostalgia.
Yeah.
Although it's like 2,000 years old, that we know that it was being left by our ancestors.
And I suppose even from an outsider's perspective, it's a lot more difficult to relate to just records.
Yep.
But when you see the item, then you feel like this was someone like me, right?
Yeah. So those were real human beings. Those were the people who lived there. Those were people who had activities over there. So by looking at these materials, then it gives us the kind of nostalgia, the kind of sense of connection between us and that area.
Thank you so much, Dr. Nasha.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to History on Repeat, the new 8-part mini-series where we think through key subjects, places and themes in Malaysia's past and also why they matter today. I've been speaking today for our first episode with Dr. Nasha Rotsiadikor, lecturer in the Centre for Global Archaeological Research at the University Science Malaysia. If you missed any part of this interview or any previous segments, you can download the podcasts on bfm.my, on our BFM app or on Spotify. You've been listening to History on Repeat on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.